Taking Stock with Susan Hayes Cullen.
Brought to you by PwC.
This is News Talk.
Well, hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes Cullerton and this is the show that looks at business and economics from a wider perspective. So coming up on today's show, what's going on at Jackson Hole and why is the annual event so important for global economics? With Electric Picnic coming into focus, we look at the economics of music festivals. Plus, as The Economist bluntly claims, Ireland is not rich, we debate this with two of our most prominent economists. Now, you can email the show, takingstock@newstalk.com, or you can message me on socials at Susan Hayes Cullerton on LinkedIn, Instagram, X, Blue Sky or Facebook. Now, I want to start off today by explaining the term underemployment, because this week we saw that there is now more than 2.8 million people in employment in Ireland for the first time. And this is the equivalent of the entire population of the Republic of Ireland in 1961. But that's not to say that they're all working either full time or as much as they want, because a person is underemployed when they would like to work more hours for more pay. And the CSO reports that a quarter of the people in Ireland who are part-time workers are underemployed. So the next time you hear that Ireland is full employment, remember, that doesn't mean there isn't more scope for more paid work to happen. Well, Electric Picnic will be the next major festival to wind off a huge summer for the Irish music festival industry. And the festivals are fast becoming much more than a simple few stages and a big speakers. They're multi-million euro productions that bring huge money into the Irish economy. So here to give us a bit more of an idea just to what extent festivals impact the Irish economy is Conor Hughes, Business Director at Core Research. So first of all, Conor, you're very welcome to Taking Stock.
Thank you very much, Susan. Appreciate that.
Well, I'm going to start off here, Conor, with I read your report with interest and there was a couple of surprises in there actually as well. You say the music industry as a whole generates 1 billion euro annually, employing over 13,400 people. And actually, there's more public interest in music than sport or politics.
Yeah, something that actually surprised us, I suppose, when we were doing this research as well on behalf of IMRO. So, yeah, music, as we know, you know, or as we would have expected, it does hold, you know, a deeply rooted place in Irish culture. And what we found was that 77% of the public had an interest in music. And if we were even to compare that to sport, it's like 49%. You know, given the money that's put into sport versus music, it really is quite interesting.
And of course, the fact that we have all of the conversation that we have around the presidential election at the moment, which is taking up a lot of airtime at dinner tables around the country, I thought that was particularly striking. But to bring it to matters at hand, Electric Picnic is going to welcome 80,000 people to Stradbally next weekend. And Conor, it costs between 25 and 30 million euro to stage the whole thing. Like, is this a profit-making machine? Or is there enormous financial risk in running something like that?
I think that's an interesting question. And I think I'd have to answer that from my own perspective. But, you know, when we look at what the public are spending when it comes to live events, you know, live events in Ireland, you know, we calculated somewhere about 786 million annually. And the majority of that, I suppose, is coming from the large scale gigs. So it would be the likes of Electric Picnic. And even when that's broken down among the different demographics, it's really interesting to see the spend among, you know, what you might consider your young adults, your 25 to 34 year olds, where on average they're spending, where the average spend is about 757 euros on music events. Generally, that age group are spending closer to 850 euros a year just attending events. So it's a massive investment.
And I was, in terms of another festival, to go on from there, Conor, I was at All Together Now in Waterford with News Talk in the Go Loud Lounge, like 30,000 festival goers, 400 performers, 20 stages, and I had a super time at it. But in your report, you mentioned that festivals attract 16% of adults and with an average spend of 194 euros per festival. And I was wondering, but the weekend ticket alone for that cost over 200 euro and would be the same for EP, never mind food and drink, etc. How did you work that out?
What we ask, we ask the public just in terms of what their annual spend would be when attending different level venues or gigs. So we asked them what they thought they spent on small venue gigs, and that would have been a gig of up to 100 people. Medium gigs were somewhere between 100 and 1,000 people, and then the large scale gigs were based on over 1,000 people. So yeah, it was just a matter of taking their spend and then grossing that up to our national population figure.
And are we good at this as a nation? I mean, you talk there about the smaller and the medium and the large venues. And as you were going through them, I was thinking of, you know, the Roisin Dove in Galway. That's where I saw Fleetwood Mac there recently, let's just say. And also, when I think of the larger events, like somewhere like All Together Now or Electric Picnic or the others, they're well over 1,000. So are we good at this as a nation, do you think?
I'd say we are. You know, all we have to do is look at, you know, some of the venues that we have. You know, when you look at even the Three Arena, I think when you look at it from a world point of view, you know, it sells out. The money that's involved in that is absolutely massive and has a huge economic impact when it comes to the Irish industry or the Irish music industry.
Well, I suppose when you think of somewhere like the Three Arena, the last time I was there actually was for the ABBA Orchestra, and I brought my dad there for Christmas, and, well, it was his Christmas present, and 13,000 capacity, you know, really well served in terms of public transport. But also I see that it's one of the top 10 busiest venues in the world.
Yeah, that's correct. And I think Emeril pointed that out within their report, that it is, you know, per capita, when you look at it, it is a great venue. You know, it's a venue that the Irish public will travel to, you know, because, again, we looked at some of the challenges around attending some of these events. And the Three Arena is definitely, it's a fan's favourite when it comes to it.
However, we've spoken a lot about some of the really good elements of music festivals, but I did want to pick up on one point, because you painted a very stark picture of this. And that's the price of passion. You were saying the average income for all sectors in Ireland is €46,567, but for those working the arts, entertainment and other service activities, they're earning an average of €28,123. What's causing such a gap, Conor?
I think, you know, when we look at it, I think some of the issues that we encountered when we were interviewing some of the musicians and artists, you know, is that when we look at streaming, for instance, you know, so much of that money is actually going outside of the country, and very little is actually going to the artists themselves. So, you know, many artists as a result are struggling to earn, you know, that sustainable income, you know. And again, we found that, you know, many of these artists and you know, screenwriters, copywriters, etc., have to supplement their income with, you know, a job that either, you know, and again, we found, you know, the hospitality industry or, you know, some of the other roles that people were doing were, you know, teaching or roles where, you know, there was a little bit of flexibility within their you know, within their day to be able to perform in the, you know, evenings or nighttime situations.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. It is more of a nighttime economy, I suppose you could say. Another number that jumped out from the report as well is how 30% of the population are attracted to large scale music events. And like when we think about Oasis Mania last weekend in Croke Park, Robbie Williams this weekend, what holds people back from going to concerts? I know you mentioned that a little bit earlier on, but could we just delve into that a little bit more? Like, there's loads of people were looking for tickets, naturally enough, for Oasis last weekend, and whether it was Taylor Swift last year and the Aviva, etc. So what holds people back?
Yeah, I think what we found was that some of the barriers were ticket prices. And again, that was something that was highlighted quite a bit with Oasis in the last week and prior to that. But you also have other factors like transportation. Not all concert goers are living in the Dublin area, so you do have transportation costs. You also have accommodation costs, and again, that is something, you know, that we tend to find that with large scale gigs, price for accommodation around the Dublin area has increased manifold.
And of course, when we look at the areas outside of Dublin, because obviously there we've talked about Three Arena or Croke Park, but if we just go further into the regions like Slane, Castle can hold up to 80,000 people. Okay, well, Marley Park, I know that's coming back in. Home to Longitude, that can hold up to 40,000 people. Curramore Estate, where Altogether was, that had 30,000 people. How do you think, as a country, we're able to handle the demand? Like, I mean, Glastonbury holds up to 210,000 people. So how well is Ireland set up to supply the music festival experience that people want?
Again, I think it's an interesting question and probably something we didn't delve into very much. But when you look at it, I think some of the issues that we have seen are, you know, accommodation and public transport. So, you know, for the large hubs around Dublin, Galway, Cork, I think we're much better equipped to deal with that. Whereas, you know, and you know, by all accounts from Altogether now, from what I've heard, many of my colleagues attended, it was, you know, the setup was really good. The infrastructure, people didn't have as many problems as they may have had before getting in and out of events. So I think we're getting better, but it's still a challenge and can be a challenge for some people.
Well, you know, there's nothing like it at the same time. That experience of being there with the artists, you know, outside, soaking up the vibes, there really is nothing like it. And it's interesting how places like Electric Picnic and Glastonbury can sell out before announcing a single name in the lineup. Altogether now sold out last March, even though it wasn't happening until August. Like, it really does seem that Irish people want more and more of these. So I think it'll be interesting to watch your research over the years indeed. So thanks so much indeed for joining me. Conor Hughes, Business Director at Core Research.
Thank you very much, Susan. Appreciate it.
Now, just to clarify, I was actually talking about Macwood Fleet in the Roisin, Dove and Galway at that time, just in case I actually got that band's name mixed up. This is Susan Hayes-Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And up next, the Fed is in the dock at Jackson Hole, and we talk to a woman who's right there at the coalface of the action. Welcome back to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes-Cullerton. Now, last week, I gave you some economic trivia questions and a shout out to Pat and Kathy, who emailed in with the correct answers. So I'm going to ask you all another two questions this week. I was at home in Dripsy for Dad's birthday last week, and it got me thinking about economic birthdays. So here's my two questions. When did the state pension begin in Ireland? And the second one is, when did the Irish Stock Exchange open? I'll give you the answers at the end of the show, but email us in if you know at takingstock@newstalk.com. Now, if you were a central banker worth your salt, there's only one place you'd want to be this weekend, and that's Jackson Hole in Wyoming. That's the location of the annual get-together of the world's most influential central bankers. So what will happen this week, and how might it affect our lives? I'm delighted to be joined by Anne Safir, who reports on all things Federal Reserve related for Reuters, and she is there at Jackson Hole as we speak. So, Anne, first of all, you're very welcome to Taking Stock.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, Anne, I'm going to walk around the Fed table here and let's take a look at the seven governors as we speak, right? We have the chair, Jay Powell, is being challenged personally and professionally by the president at every turn. Christopher Waller and Michelle Bowman dissented at the last decision to hold rates when they felt they should be cut. Adriana Kogler resigned unexpectedly and she's replaced by Stephen Merrin, who would be very supportive of Trump's encouragement to cut. Lisa Cook said she won't be bullied out and is staying put. And Philip Jefferson hasn't publicly commented since May and Michael Barr hasn't publicly commented since June. What shape is the Fed in?
Well, I mean, I'd say it's kind of in the shape that it always is. It's they always like to say that they're head down and focused on the data and their job, which is to keep employment full and inflation in check. Of course, they've been falling down on the keeping inflation in check a bit lately, which is why they've been keeping rates steady, which is what is making Trump so mad. Just one addition to what you said, Stephen Miron was nominated, but he is not actually at the Fed yet. And so he has no voice officially. But of course, as you say, the Trump administration has been putting a lot of pressure. And, Myron, even from the outside, can exert some influence, at least in, as far as perception goes, as far as which way the Fed should go.
So, of course, one of the big questions of 2025 is the question related to the independence of the Fed, and everything there that you've just said is a big issue. Like, number one is, of course, a lot of the inflation we might direct it towards the impact of tariffs, and certainly we'll get to that. Second thing is political appointees. The third one is the social media and other pressure from the president. I mean, is there now a big existential question about how independent the Fed can actually be, Anne?
I mean, there's absolutely an existential question about it. And I think that that is, making a lot of the central bankers who are here in Jackson Hole quite worried, because if the Fed can't be independent, that's going to have huge implications for the world financial markets. I mean, there's no indication at the moment that anything that the administration is doing is actually forcing the Fed one way or the other. But as you can see, as the more people that Trump is able to get on the Fed and the more pressure he's able to put there, the less you kind of believe that what they're doing is because of what they see in the economy and rather what they the president wants them to do.
And that's why I think the story that's evolving with Lisa Cook is so interesting, is because she says she's going to stay put. We've seen Trump now speaking about this on Truth Social, where he has said exactly what he wants her to do. So the world is watching here. But one way or the other, Anne, the decisions made by the Fed have massive ramifications. So no matter how the world feels about its independence, still the impact of those decisions are still going to be felt, aren't they?
Oh, yes, for sure. The U.S. interest rates are, sort of the bedrock of the global financial system. For the Fed to make a decision one way or the other is going to affect what goes on around the world. And that's why people pay attention. One thing that I would note, Lisa Cook herself says that she won't be bullied. And I'd also note that there is no power by, for instance, Trump or Fed Chair Powell, should he choose to fire her. It's a position that you get and you get to stick in for 14 years.
That's right. I mean, I see that her tenure is up until 2038. It's quite a while yet that she has to sit on the board as a governor. In contrast to our own central bank here in the Eurozone, it's something you've already mentioned, but that the Fed has a dual mandate. It's focused on price stability at the 2% level and maintaining full employment. Now, while inflation is showing signs of rising, and we'll delve into that a bit more, the employment data is showing signs of cooling off. Which do you think it will prioritise now? Because they're moving in different directions.
That is absolutely true. And that is what puts them in a pickle, what would put any central bank with a dual mandate like this in a pickle. For now, many of the Fed policymakers who are speaking, Cleveland Fed President Beth Hammack actually made this point. Inflation is the primary issue for her. That's what they're seeing the miss on. At least a percentage point above the 2% that they want to hit. Whereas the employment, it's really hard to read what's happening in terms of the cooling job gains because we've seen such a drop in immigration and we're seeing all the deportations, and that's affecting the whole labor market. So you can't read the monthly jobs numbers the same way that you might have read last year when we were having, hundreds of thousands of immigrants coming in potentially, in a single month.
And Anne, isn't there another reason that the labour market is hard to read? And that is down to, well, let me explain where I'm going to go with this. The Bureau of Labour Statistics has had a lot of cuts to it in recent times. Like, for example, the scrap data collection in several cities, its funding in real terms was 18% lower for the fiscal year in 2024 than in 2009. The agency is facing an 8% budget cut next year with 150 fewer staff, and they only have about 2,000 anyway. And I haven't even mentioned the changing of the boss. So isn't that part of the problem, is that the ability of the Bureau of Labour Statistics to do its job is significantly weakened, and therefore then that contributes to the effectiveness of the decisions thereafter?
Well, I mean, absolutely, we've seen a huge degradation in the survey response rate for the Bureau of Labor Statistics in the last, actually, since the pandemic. That's been an ongoing problem. At the same time, there is no other world, no other big statistic in the whole world that is sort of watched as closely as the U.S. monthly jobs numbers. And yes, they do get revived. They do get revised, and this time the revisions were quite large. But I wouldn't say that that means that they're not believable. It's just that you have to, you know, understand that they're taken on the basis of surveys, and then they're revised later based as they get more information in. So I would say that there's always a trade-off between getting information very quickly and getting information very accurately, and I think that that's what we're seeing with those monthly job gains numbers.
And I can see where you're coming from on that. But I'm trying to find another word, but I can't. But when I think about what we've seen in the summer, like, the public attention usually goes to the number that comes out first. But when you look at it, this summer, the jobs numbers were revised down by 250,000 to the point of where the actual average gain is only 35,000 jobs. Like, that is a striking reduction in estimates, first of all, into the substance of what's actually happening in the US economy.
It's astounding, absolutely. And we've actually only seen this very rarely. I think the last time it was that this big was during the pandemic, because we had huge changes that were totally unexpected and totally unprecedented, obviously, in the world economy at the time. And that's kind of what's happening here. To develop those estimates for the monthly job gains, they use estimates of what's going on in the underlying labor force. And when you have huge changes in the amount of immigration to the U.S., that changes that labor force number dramatically. And that's what we're seeing. And it does. It gives you pause. Mm. It makes you think twice about the numbers. At the same time, I don't think that it undermines them completely. And markets certainly are taking big signal from it. Fed policymakers are taking less signal from the actual job gains than from the rates, like the unemployment rate, which has actually been quite steadily and quite low and has not risen. So those Fed policymakers, that's another reason why they're more concerned about inflation, I would say, generally, than they are about the employment, because the inflation they're seeing, the miss definitely is there. And on the employment side, it's a lot less obvious. You could see that, as you said, this big cooling in the jobs that are being generated in the economy, but you don't see the same change in the unemployment rate. So that makes them feel that it's stable. There are definitely growing voices at the Fed with more concern about the labor market, and we're going to have to see what the data shows coming up to their next meeting in September.
And so, Anne, I want to get into the inflation number for sure. Before I do, I want to go back to something that you said earlier about the markets and how they're reacting. Because in the month following each of Powell's last seven Jackson Hole speeches, the dollar rose 1.4% and the S&P 500 fell by 2% on average. But this year we have a weaker dollar and a more richly valued stock market. So are the markets all the more poised to react this time?
I mean, I think that they will certainly react if he gives even so much of a hint that the rate cut is off, or conversely, that the rate cut is on. I mean, we just don't really, we don't expect him to give a definite signal one way or the other, but we do expect him to say something. And I think markets will react, as you say. Jackson Hole is the place to be, is the place to watch this week.
I would love to be out there. I have to say, it's on my bucket list. I would love to be at Jackson Hole. What is it like on the ground out there at the moment? Is there a sense of anticipation, or is there a sense that we're at a turning point, or what? No, I'm putting words in your mouth here. You tell us, what is it like?
You know, the thing is, it's so normal here because we're in the middle of this giant national park. There's all these tourists just going about their own business, checking out the wildlife. I saw a badger just a few hundred feet from the lodge here yesterday. I mean, it's crazy beautiful out here. And But the central bankers are really focused on what Powell is going to say and on what comes out of this economic symposium. And they're kind of, I've spoken to a couple who are, you know, they're dismayed by all of this pressure that the Trump administration is putting on them and feel a lot of empathy, you know, for Governor Cook as well.
And also, Anne, is it time, I'm going to use that word again, to have existential conversations around, like, should the Fed be pursuing both mandates still? Should it be more separated from politics? Is 2% the right target? Are those types of conversations, like, I would imagine Jackson Hole is the place of any place to be having those if they're to be had, or is it just focused on the news of the day, the conversation and what faces the country right now?
Oh, I think it's very much in the more in the broader long-term sense that you're suggesting. Although the three things that you mentioned, I think that they would have very pat answers for. 2% inflation, no, they're not going to change that. That is not up for discussion. The Fed's going to be announcing a new framework, probably with Powell's speech on Friday, and they're going to keep that 2% inflation. I think, you know, Fed independence, of course the Fed should remain independent. That's what central bankers from around the world think. Whether it will or not, and to what degree, that's the big question. And that is an existential question that they will be talking about. I think, you just wonder what it's going to be like at that giant table where they're discussing policy when, you know, several of the people are making comments that, you know, are just coming direct from the mind of the president.
And of course, I have to ask you about inflation because it is the name of the game when it comes to this conversation. And if we look at the nuance behind it, right, the producer's price index, it increased by 3.3%, well ahead of that 2% number. And now I know that's not the specific number that the decision makers are reliant upon, but it is a predictive analytic, right? So that was driven by an increase in margins for wholesalers and retailers and a jump in the sub-index tracking charges for fund managers. Core inflation, which strips out food and energy, that rose 2.8%, ahead of expectations and up from 2.5% gain in July. So my question to you is, is tariff-induced inflation a once-off hike that will be locked into prices and that's that, or a fundamental shift in the price level in the economy?
I mean, that is the question, right? I mean, I think that you would think that it would just lift up prices once and then that would be it, but with the Trump administration changing tariff policy, you know, almost week to week, rolling out new tariffs that, you know, we hadn't even thought about before. And then on the company side, they've been holding off passing a lot of that on to the consumers before they know what the tariff rate actually will be, because they don't want their, you know, clients to get all mad at them if they don't have to raise prices that high. So they're going to be rolling it out kind of slower. And so that's the fear, is that it will be this sort of slow roll upward push on prices that could get into people's thinking and could push up inflation. And that's what Fed policymakers are mostly scared about.
And it's been fascinating to talk to you. And I wish you the very best in that beautiful part of the world. As I say, hopefully I'll meet you there at some stage. Thanks so much indeed. Anne Safir from Reuters.
Thanks so much for having me.
This is Susan Hayes-Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, we look at claims by The Economist magazine that Ireland is not, in fact, a rich country. Now you're welcome back to Taking Stock here on News Talk. I'm Susan Hayes-Cullerton, and I want to read out some messages from last week. One came in from Declan and Catherine, who said, "We got a lot out of that chat with Declan Power. Catherine thought that military spending is like insurance, handy to have when you need it." And Declan indicated that Ireland may not have the need or ability to manage a full-scale fighter aircraft defence capability, but we would provide radar facilities to allies, which would be a valuable contribution. And I thought of the time that weather reports from Black Sod and Mayo on the eve of the planned D-Day invasion played a big role in a successful outcome. So thank you very much indeed for that message to Declan and Catherine. Also, I was talking to a listener called John, who told me that he resonated strongly with my mother's technique of watching YouTube commentary of a Premier League match while watching the same match and commenting himself on the quality of both. So you're in good company, John. Well, as a country, how rich are we? We love to think of our economic success. That it means we're up there with the best, but some people think our wealth is illusory and based on an interesting tax rule. However, this came into focus this week when The Economist magazine decided not to rank us in the 178 richest economies. But I wonder, are we looking in the wrong place? So now I'm joined by two of our most prominent economists to find out. It's great to welcome Kate English, Chief Economist from Deloitte, and Jim Power. First of all, you're both very welcome to Taking Stock.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Susan.
Well, we'll just start off here because all week, and the commentary has run on all week long about this, is that Ireland is not rich enough to make the Economist Rich List, and I will get to that with you both, but I would like to start off by looking at this a little bit differently because I found it interesting that the Economist is defining a country's richness not just by how much money the country earns, but how much its earnings are relative to local costs. And then how many hours it takes to earn that money in the first place. So, for example, Switzerland tops the list when it comes to average earnings, but when you adjust for local costs, Singapore moves ahead. And if you adjust that for the number of hours worked, Norway leads the way. So, Jim, what do you think of this methodology in the first place?
Well, as you say, it's trying to measure monetary richness, I guess. You know, it's GDP per capita at market exchange rates. It's incomes adjusted for local costs. That's pursing per parish. In other words, how much your income will buy, and then the number of hours worked to earn that. So it's a very limited measure. It's a very limited set of metrics. And, you know, I wouldn't get carried away about this. I don't think it is of great significance because there is a lot more to the richness of a country than those three simple metrics. You know, it doesn't look, and it's not intended to, but this doesn't look at issues like quality of life, public services, life expectancy, etc. And all of those sorts of variables have to be taken into account to really get a sense of broadly defined how rich a country really is. The fact that Ireland didn't make the top list of 178 countries, I think, is irrelevant. And I can see why The Economist is doing that, because it says that the GDP calculations in Ireland, it describes them as polluted tax arbitrage. I wouldn't disagree with that. And it also says that accountants are as versed in the arts of surreal creativity as James Joyce. So in other words, The Economist doesn't really understand how Ireland measures its economy based on GDP metrics. And I have to say, as somebody who used to regularly attend the CSO's quarterly briefing on the national accounts, I left totally disillusioned with it all, because every quarter it is just indecipherable stuff. It's very difficult to understand. It's very difficult to get a real picture. And that is reflected in The Economist's perspective on this. So, I would not take it as a personal slight or as a negative, the fact that we aren't included, because we just have to look at ourselves. It doesn't matter what The Economist thinks. We look ourselves at what the quality of life is like on the ground in this country. And that's where you come to, I think, a real measure of just how rich, broadly defined, Ireland really is.
Kate, Jim has said a lot there, but I want to really hone in on the point about we need to be looking at things like you said there, like quality of life, public services, life expectancy. And if we look at the Beyond GDP report that the OECD published at the end of last year, it was referring to things like the average household in the OECD has about $35,000 per capita available to spend. In 2023, 78% of those aged 25 to 64 were employed. And about 1 in 14 employees routinely worked 50 hours or more each week in 2022. And then it highlighted that that was impinging on their leisure time, personal care and ability to contribute to unpaid work within a household. So as economists, should we be paying more attention to the types of measures that Jim is referring to and that the Beyond GDP report from the OECD is referring to as well?
I think absolutely. As an economist, it's drilled into us that one data point does not tell all. And I think that is really the case when we look at Irish economics, again, as Jim eloquently pointed out, with GDP. It doesn't necessarily give us the full story of what's happening on the ground. But we can actually say that about any economy. All economies are different shapes, sizes. We have different sectors that account for different parts of those economies. And so we need to ensure that we're looking at many different data points at all times, because they don't always correlate with each other at times too. We see contradictions, one which is showing growth and the other which is showing a contraction or a decline. So it's a lesson to us all to ensure that we do not focus on just one metric. And actually the central bank are very, the ECB, the European Central Bank, Christine Lagarde, the president, when she speaks in her press conference each month looking at interest rates, she's very careful at correcting herself of when we say we are looking at data to make our decisions. It's not just one data point, it's data in its plural. Many different indicators that tell us about how an economy is performing. And I think that piece by the OECD, it was a second in a long running series looking at beyond GDP, what counts for economic and social performance within an economy. And we actually did even get inequality data out only in the last 2 days from Eurostat, looking at what is called the Gini index or the Gini coefficient. And in that ranking, Ireland looks a little bit different or more improved than what it has in more recent years. So absolutely many different data points need to be taken into account.
Right, Tim. And let's then do the work that we might have thought the economists might have done this time. And actually, let's just talk about how well Ireland is doing, because when I went looking for a couple of statistics relating back to that Beyond GDP report, here's what I found. First of all, Eurostat says that our actual individual consumption is about the same as the EU average. And the CSO, with their details out this week around employment figures, said that our employment rate for people aged 15 to 64 years, is 74.7%. So, like, broadly speaking, we're on par with the European average. So how do you think Ireland is faring?
As Kate said, there's a lot of different metrics you need to look at. I mean, one of the biggest issues here in Ireland, and this dates back to July of 2016, when the CSO published the first quarter 2016 GDP or the national accounts. And as an aside, it said at the beginning, oh, and by the way, we've revised GDP for 2015 from 6.8% to over 25%. And that was the day that Paul Krugman famously described Ireland as
leprechaun economics. The three of us are
in response to that, the CSO developed another indicator called GNI Star, Gross National Income Modified. And last year, for example, our GDP was $563 billion. And if the Economist magazine had decided to run with that, Ireland would be very close to the top of the 178 countries. But it doesn't believe that GDP number and consequently left Ireland out. But if you look at GNI Star last year, which is an Irish construct and doesn't get very much recognition overseas, but last year our GNI Star was worth $321 billion. And that's a difference of $242 billion, okay, which is absolutely massive. And that does give us a better sense of what's happening on the ground in the economy. You know, there's no doubt about that. But Kate mentioned the data from Eurostat this week, the Gini coefficient, showing that in the last 10 years, income equality in Ireland has increased pretty dramatically. And we are now more equal income distribution-wise than, for example, Sweden and Denmark, which are traditionally put up there as the dions of virtue. Okay, so that's a very positive indicator. You mentioned the labour force survey, which was released last Thursday. It showed another record level of employment being achieved in the economy. But it also showed, as you said, the highest employment rate on record at 74.7%. So, and if you look at, you know, average consumption, so on a lot of metrics, life expectancy, Ireland has improved dramatically in that regard in recent years and figures pretty highly now in an international context. So there's a lot of stuff where Ireland scores very highly. But then you look at the quality of some of our public services, and the Competition Authority, you know, it refers to this in the annual competitiveness report. You know, there are problems with transport, the quality of some public services like health, for example, and indeed education are not as good as they should be. So I think where we we can be marked down is on the quality of public services. And okay, it's difficult to make international comparisons. You know, how do you describe a country's health service relative to another country's health service? People might say, well, it's obviously how much you spend per head of population, but that depends on the age profile of the population as well. So it's not quite, it's very difficult to make these comparisons. But if you look at it in an absolute sense, if you look at the housing issue here, if you look at the quality of public transport, if you look at the quality of health, if you look at the manner in which education has been defunded over the years, they're all areas that Ireland really needs to do a lot better at.
Right, Kate. Again, there's a lot there. And, you know, it's incumbent on us here to make sure that we are, as we're looking at the Irish economy, looking at it from a balanced point of view. And there's a range of things there that Jim said are strong, but also the things that could be improved on. And I found it interesting that Beyond GDP report from the OECD was 109 pages long, and I had to get past page 100 before I found these two findings at the very end. One is that not a single country in the OECD had improved in all headline indicators across natural, economic, human and social capita for future well-being over the past decade. However, two countries, Ireland and Hungary, managed to avoid deterioration in any of those in those headlines. And the second finding was current well-being in Australia, Estonia, Iceland and Ireland is comparatively high today relative to 2010. Now, Kate, I don't have to remind you or any listener where we were in 2010, namely in a bailout situation. So what's your take on where we stand today as a country? Because, of course, another point that I'm sure people are screaming at us as we're talking about this is, of course, infrastructure and housing as well.
I think similar to Jim's comments too, when we look across a number of different indicators, and they've already been touched on, from labour market to our household savings ratio, our deposit rates as well, they are quite exceptional, and particularly in more recent years, that would place Ireland on quite a good footing. And again, this was debated in a report recently by the central bank, well, not so recently, about 2 years ago, that uses a number of different measures, and it places us above the EU average, but more so probably around 8th or 9th position if we were to compare on a GNI star basis, which is what Jim already mentioned. But when we do compare it to infrastructure delivery and housing, that is where we fall down. So again, when we look at the European Competitiveness Index, Ireland sits really high in that. But where our lowest rating is for basic infrastructure. And what is included within that basic infrastructure category? It's your housing, your energy and your water. And of course, this has been debated at length actually within Ireland only in recent months, as we saw the revised National Development Plan was released, and there was a lot of focus on, well, how much are we actually spending on water infrastructure to address those gaps that are there? And there's no denying, when we compare against other European or global countries, that is where we fall down the rankings. But I think it's again back to what you said at the very outset of this, is that we shouldn't view it as negatively, so to speak, that we're not included in the Economist ranking. It's not saying that Ireland is not a wealthy country or that we do not have an economy that is performing. It just simply used a metric that isn't the best used to describe Ireland's economic growth story. But if we were to look across a number of different indicators, Ireland would appear within that ranking and compare quite well to a European average, I believe.
Well, if there's one thing that The Economist did for us, it is leading us to have this conversation right across the country. And you've both have contributed very, very well to it today. Thank you very much indeed. Kate English, Chief Economist from Deloitte, and Jim Power. Now that's it for this week's Taking Stock with me, Susan Hayes Cullerton. I hope you enjoyed the show and possibly even learned something about economics and how it affects our world. I'm going to give you the answers now to my two questions from earlier. The Irish pension was paid out on New Year's Day on 1909 for the first time. That was actually the same year that my granddad and my mum's side was born, actually. And the Irish Stock Exchange opened in 1793. And of course, that was 5 years before the 1798 rebellion. Now, I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast first on Friday mornings on the News Talk app or wherever you go to get your podcasts. And please do subscribe to us while you're there. It's also on the radio every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. The producer of Taking Stock is John Fardy, and on research this week was Stephen Daunt and Simon Keane. Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. Thanks so much for listening, and enjoy the rest of your day. And I look forward to chatting to you again next week.